Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Maddie Dalplain.
And I'm Grace Jenkins. It's Friday, January 8th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today we're talking to Jens von Bergmann about his analysis of the December 23rd COVID modeling presentation slides and the lack of data made available to the public.
But first, we've got an interview with Jessica Magonet from the BC Civil Liberties Association regarding the use of solitary confinement in Canadian prisons.
So, to set this up a little bit, there have been a lot of developments in prisoners' rights over the last several years, in large part due to wins like the 2018 case won by the BCCLA and the John Howard Society against the Attorney General of Canada, in which the BC Supreme Court ruled that the use of indefinite solitary confinement was unconstitutional and violated prisoners' Section 7 charter rights. But according to an article released by the Vancouver Sun earlier this week, despite these major legal wins, a panel report released in October shows that Correctional Services Canada is not abiding by the legal changes that were fought for by organizations like the BCCLA. So I wanted to speak with Jessica to get a better idea of what exactly is happening in prisons across the country and in BC, like what changes, if any, have been made as a result of recent legislation, and see what impact the pandemic has had on solitary confinement in recent months.
It's a short one, but Jessica covered a lot of ground. Let's have a listen.
All right, well, great. I guess to get started, can you start off just by telling our listeners your name, your preferred pronouns, and just a little bit about the work that you do with the BCCLA?
Certainly. So my name is Jessica Magonet. I use she, her pronouns, and I am staff counsel in the litigation department of the BC Civil Liberties Association. So I work on cases that we launch or intervene in and on a variety of issues, including prisoners' rights, medical assistance in dying, police powers, all sorts of different human rights and civil liberties issues.
Fantastic. Since I was really hoping to talk a little bit about solitary confinement specifically, could you just start out with sort of a basic definition? Like, what exactly is considered solitary confinement, and why should Canadians be concerned about the practice?
Of course. So in international law, solitary confinement is defined as at least 22 hours locked up in a cell without any meaningful human contact. And solitary confinement in excess of 15 days is considered to amount to torture in international law. And the reason Canadians should be concerned about solitary confinement and prolonged solitary confinement in particular is it has really, really devastating effects on prisoners. It leads to higher rates of self-harm, suicide. It's just a horrific practice, and prolonged solitary confinement continues to be practiced in Canada in federal and provincial institutions.
Okay, and so back in 2018, the BCCLA and the John Howard Society won a pretty significant victory against solitary confinement in the BC Supreme Courts. Can you tell me a little bit of the background of the case and what exactly this ruling accomplished?
Certainly. So the BCCLA and the John Howard Society challenged a Canadian law setting out the administrative segregation regime in federal prisons, which effectively allowed for indefinite solitary confinement. And the BC Supreme Court ruled that that law was unconstitutional, and the BC Court of Appeal in 2019 agreed that this law violated the rights protected by Section 7 of the Charter to life, liberty, and security of the person because it allowed for prolonged indefinite solitary confinement. So that was a very significant victory. And there have actually been other cases across the country finding that this practice is unconstitutional.
Okay, great. And you said that it's still, that solitary confinement is still practiced in Canada. And I was recently reading that there was an advisory panel report, I think it was released in October, that was discussing the use of something called structured intervention units, or SIUs, in federal prisons. So some people are saying that SIUs are essentially the same thing as solitary confinement, just sort of like repackaged. What exactly are structured intervention units, and are they any different from what we think of as sort of just like standard issue solitary confinement?
Sure. So to back up a bit, what happened is that the government, in response to these court cases, had to deal with its law that the courts said was unconstitutional. And they passed a new law in November 2019, replacing the administrative segregation regime with these structured intervention units. And under this new law, prisoners were allowed up to they were allowed the opportunity of 4 hours of meaningful human contact per day instead of two. So this was the revolutionary change in this law that you could only be locked up for 20 hours a day in solitary instead of 22 hours per day. So it was no longer technically solitary confinement. Our organization and many other organizations said that this law would not pass constitutional muster if enacted, but the government went ahead with it anyways. And a major concern we had with this law is it did not place a hard cap on the number of days you could spend in an SIU. And the Ontario Court of Appeal had ruled that any solitary confinement in excess of 15 days was unconstitutional. The BC Court of Appeal had said any prolonged solitary confinement was unconstitutional. So we thought this lack of a hard cap was a serious problem. And then you just referred to the October report done by Dube and Sprott, which found that, in fact, despite this new law, very little has changed. They found that almost half of placements in SIUs last for more than 15 days, and only 5.7% of prisoners were able to spend 4 hours outside of their cell every day. So this new law, which we thought didn't go far enough, isn't even being followed, and the problem remains despite these numerous judicial decisions saying this practice is unconstitutional.
Oh man. I also wanted to shift and speak a little bit about some of the risk assessment tools that are being used by correctional services in Canada. So another article by the Globe and Mail last week reported that a tool called the custody rating scale hasn't been updated in like 16 years. And it highlights that when Public Safety Canada reviewed the tool's development all the way back in 2004, they found that there were concerns for unfair assessment of Black and Indigenous folks who were left vulnerable to bias and systemic discrimination. Can you also sort of briefly explain what exactly the custody rating scale is and why there's cause for concern regarding racially based discrimination? And what does all of this have to do with solitary confinement?
Definitely. So I'm not that familiar with that specific tool, but what I can tell you for sure is that there have long been concerns raised about the impact of risk assessment tools on Indigenous and racialized people, and that these tools are biased against such people. And concerns about these tools were raised in the Supreme Court of Canada case called Ewart, which our organization was involved in. And I think the types of concerns raised by these tools sort of point to, or is related to, the fact that Indigenous and racialized people are overrepresented in our correctional system. Indigenous people are overrepresented in solitary confinement. The BC Supreme Court found that the administrative segregation regime actually violated the equality rights of Indigenous peoples. So there's significant racism in the way that our prison system works, and the impacts of solitary confinement are unfortunately disproportionately felt by Indigenous people.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just so many different sort of levels to this. But now with the ongoing pandemic, can you talk a little bit about the relationship between solitary confinement and COVID-19, and specifically some of the concerns regarding using solitary as sort of like a means of quarantine, for example?
I'm happy to speak about this. It's a completely devastating and egregious situation. There are many reports that prisoners who test positive for COVID-19 in both federal and provincial institutions are being placed in solitary confinement as a form of quarantine. This is egregious and completely anathema to public health. We're hearing reports that prisoners are afraid to report symptoms because they're afraid of being placed in solitary and of dying in solitary. There are also significant reports of prisons using lockdowns where there is a COVID case, which is effectively means putting everybody in the prison in solitary to stop the spread of COVID, which is a terrible public health strategy, completely inconsistent with international human rights law. Many organizations have spoken out against this. I was reading that recently prisoners at the Saskatchewan Penitentiary were going on hunger strike to protest this. The Office of the Correctional Investigator, which is Canada's federal prison watchdog, has called the reliance on these lockdowns unacceptable and contrary to international human rights law. So this is not the appropriate way to deal with COVID in prisons.
Yeah. What are some of these organizations calling for instead as far as how to handle COVID appropriately in a way that's more humane and effective?
Well, a big thing that they're calling for and that our organization has called for is the release of incarcerated people who can be released into the community, particularly people who present a low risk. And unfortunately, Canada really missed the boat on doing that, despite really strong calls for action from civil society, particularly before the second wave of COVID hit. To get people out of prison who did not need to be there and people who were at significant risk of serious adverse health effects if they caught COVID. And then for the individuals who they can't release, ensuring that people are not locked up for 24 hours a day with no access to any meaningful human contact or legal counsel, providing some level of human contact, telephone or video, but not just locking people away and calling it a public health strategy. Just to add, because this has been in the news recently, prioritizing prisons as a place where people need to be vaccinated because there's, you know, people are living in confined quarters. It's like a long-term care home where if one person gets COVID, it can really spread like wildfire.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Where are prisons essentially falling in the vaccination rollout plans at this point?
I'm not sure, but I know it's been the subject of debate with the leader of the Conservative Party saying that they should be basically at the bottom of the list, which is so, so upsetting.
For anybody, any of our listeners who would like to sort of get involved in prisoners' rights around solitary confinement, want to support the BCCLA, what can we do?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can support organizations through donations or signing petitions and open letters. Some organizations working on this issue include our own, the John Howard Society, Prisoners Legal Services, Elizabeth Fry, the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, the Canadian Association of Prison Lawyers. There are really a lot of groups trying to take action here.
Okay, fantastic. And is there anything ongoing currently with the BCCLA that you'd like to mention or highlight?
I guess I would just mention that solitary confinement is an issue that the BCCLA has been working on for an extremely long time. And we celebrated our legal victories in this area and are disappointed that despite clear statements from top courts in many provinces, the government isn't taking action. Like, this is, it just, in a country like Canada, this should not be happening anymore.
Definitely not. And I guess on that note, is there anything that you feel like I've missed or anything else that you would like to add before I let you go?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time, Jessica. It was really great getting to speak with you.
Take care, Maddie.
I'm Christine Dibble.
And I'm Carla Slytome.
And we are the KNC Jazz Duo. And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Have you heard about Megaphone Magazine?
It's an award-winning publication sold on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria by low-income and homeless vendors. When you buy Megaphone, you get entertaining and informative stories written by professional journalists, and you're also helping to empower people in poverty. Here's how it works. Vendors buy each magazine for 75 cents and sell them for $2, keeping the profits. With the money they earn, our vendors are able to buy healthy food, clothing, and other necessities, plus they forge valuable connections with their customers.
This year I earned enough income to take a trip to Victoria, meet lots of new people, and had an awesome time.
Don't miss out on this month's edition of Megaphone, chock full of voices and perspectives that you won't find anywhere else. Track down a vendor using our free Find a Vendor app, downloadable at megaphonemagazine.com.
And welcome back to On The Point by CITR 101.9 FM. This is your source for alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You just heard an interview with Jessica Magnet from the BCCLA about use of solitary confinement and SIUs in Canadian prisons.
I wanted to follow up on something mentioned in the interview with Jessica. In the interview, we briefly mentioned the vaccination rollout plan for prisoners across Canada and in BC. According to CTV News, starting as early as today, as part of a pilot project, up to 600 federal inmates at federal institutions across Canada will be vaccinated. The Union of Canadian Corrections Officers hasn't said which prisons will actually receive the vaccine yet, but they say that they will prioritize sick and elderly inmates. The announcement has been stoking quite a bit of criticism, mainly among conservative leaders like Erin O'Toole. But according to health officials, 3.5% of prisoners in Canada have gotten COVID in just the month of December. So those numbers are very significant. And those who are incarcerated also tend to be in poorer general health than the general population is. And up to a quarter of Canada's prison population is also over the age of 50. And as of now, we don't see anything being mentioned specifically for BC prisons. But yet again, we are seeing conservative leaders in BC criticize any notions of vaccinating prisoners ahead of other parts of the population. But hopefully we can see more developments in the plan shortly.
It's the rhetoric coming from like Erin O'Toole and all of those people. It reminds me a lot of a very sort of diluted rhetoric that we saw against people with underlying conditions like way early on in the pandemic. They're like, oh hey, like a lot of like you're only at risk if you have an underlying condition, so it's fine if you go outside or whatever. Or when it's like I think the premier of Manitoba was like saying, oh, we shouldn't prioritize Indigenous people because some racist reason. I forgot what he said. But yeah, this is the same exact thing, because if you see a vaccine as a privilege and not a right, then you will get these ridiculous notions, and if you don't like look at the common good, very silly, very very stupid. And I saw Erin O'Toole getting a lot of pushback yesterday, but I mean it's as we talk about later, like this sort of stuff doesn't stop at the border. Let's just say that much.
You sort of see all the same discussions happening whenever you find an excuse to dehumanize an entire subsect of the population. And, you know, it's no different than with people who are being held in federal facilities for crimes of whatever magnitude. And, you know, I think that there's this like misconception around looking at prisoners instead of like as criminals and inherently less human, as opposed to people who literally are under, they're essentially the responsibility of the federal government. And they are being kept in confined spaces, so they should be looked at more like, you know, communal care homes, because COVID will spread across that population the same way it would in a care facility. So.
And another thing to add, obviously, is Indigenous people are hugely overrepresented in prisons. Like, I believe Chantal Bellechard reported something like 60% of Canada's population is prison population, that is Indigenous, which is just shocking, like considering what it's 10% for the general population of Canada's Indigenous. So, you know, that's also a factor that must be taken into place. And it's not unintentional that Erin O'Toole said all of this stuff. Let's just put it that way. Anyway, on the topic of people making bad public health decisions, our next interview is with Jens von Bergman from Mountain Math, a Vancouver-based data visualization company. Jens recently published a blog post called BC Back to COVID School, analyzing how the province is presenting outbreak data in schools.
In the blog post, Jens breaks down how the province's data presentation around school transmissions is unclear, and also calls out how parents are losing confidence in the public health orders around schools. We decided to talk to him about how a better data approach would look and some more insight.
Let's have a listen, and this interview was done by Isa Yu.
Hi, Jens. Thank you so much for joining. Could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
So I'm Jens von Bergman, and I'm used to be a mathematician. I have a PhD in mathematics, but now I do data analysis, visualization. And I have a company here in Vancouver called Mountain Math, where I do that.
So you recently published a blog post about the problems with the COVID-19 data available, especially in relation to school-aged children. What prompted this blog post?
Well, as school started, I was kind of late, but I decided to read through the a modeling projection from December 23rd that looked in particular also at schools, and just to get some guidance of what we know, what we've learned from a full, like a half year now of schools. And and I was a bit frustrated reading through the slides.
Yeah, so could you give us a quick rundown of the biggest problems you found within the slides?
I think from just the big problem is that if you look at the slides, it feels kind of like every slide is sort of different. It's a different type of thing. The timeframes change. Some of the measures that are being considered change. It kind of feels like, when you're running up against a deadline and you have to put out a slide presentation and you ask all your friends saying, hey, do you know anything about schools? And they're saying, well, you know, I did this thing a couple of weeks ago. Here's something. And it just, you kind of assemble it, a bunch of kind of not really related slides, and put them all together and you have something to say. But that's very different from doing an analysis and seeing what actually, taking a really coherent look at what is happening in the schools, what we have learned, what has worked, what hasn't, how we're gonna move forward. And that really is, for me, the biggest problem that I've seen there.
Yeah, so the argument against implementing stricter COVID guidelines is that transmission in schools is rare, but you've been crunching the numbers. So what's the data actually say?
Well, so yeah, let's take a step back. That's a tricky one. So what we do know is, and what's the slides have been focusing on, is not transmissions in schools. Those are hard to measure, partially because we know that a lot of children especially are asymptomatic. We think about half of children that have COVID are gonna be asymptomatic, but we only test people that are symptomatic. So we're probably gonna miss sort of a good half or more of all cases. So talking about transmissions in a situation where we know we are missing probably half or more of all cases, it's really hard because we're just not seeing the whole picture. At the same time then, what else? So what do we know? We can talk a little bit about transmissions where we do test. What we can also talk about just where are these events where these transmissions may happen. So what we do have data on is exposure events. So it's every time somebody who we know had COVID was in a school in a situation where there might have been other people impacted by this. So these are the exposure letters. But so that's something that we can focus on. We don't have data on this in a sense of something easy to work with, but these exposure letters are being sent out. And there's a volunteer effort by parents that collects all of these, details them, assigns them to schools, and makes a comprehensive list of all those. So that's great. There have been about 1,800 of them over the school year. And then what the slides do is they focus on schools that have had an exposure event. That number is of course much smaller because some schools have had multiple exposure events. Some have had over 20. And so what the slides do is they focus on, well, how many schools have had exposure event? Not that many. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. If we want to think about transmissions and what leads to transmissions, we want to look at overall exposures. It makes a big difference if a school has had 20 exposures or just one. The experience of the parents, of the teachers, of the children in that school is very different. The risk that we face at that school is very different. And I think we probably should think about different protocols and measures that we implement to make sure that transmissions don't happen. And that's something that's just absent, completely absent from the analysis that we've had at by the province.
So the Fraser Health shared with the Surrey Teachers Association that they only count it as a school transmission if they can conclusively rule out that there is transmission out in the community. So from a data analysis point of view, how might this stringent definition of school transmissions affect the numbers?
Right, so so that's when we're looking at when there is a case, they're trying to figure out where the case came from. So that's some kind of linking between cases, which is inherently difficult, right? So if two people get it, you don't know if it one person got it from the other or which way around. Some people develop symptoms much later than others. So even if the timeline is that one person, say two close friends, both are diagnosed with COVID 1 3 days after the other, we would like to assume that the person that got diagnosed first probably was the source of this infection for the second. We don't know that for sure though, it could have been reversed. So because of this, and because sometimes people meet in multiple settings, these people might've met at school, but also might've had a play date. Where did the infection occur? We don't know. So it's very hard to link those cases, and we're making assumptions and we're trying to make our best assumptions. So the assumption that you just said was sort of gives preference to out of school settings, which is questionable as a strategy. But we have to make a lot of assumptions. I think it's important to recognize that this is inherently difficult to do, which also then makes it hard to make definitive statements about in-school transmission, because we simply don't really know very well how to associate those.
Yeah, well, what do you think it says when people have to extrapolate data from like the vague graphs that we've seen?
It is frustrating. I mean, I think really what I would like to believe is that we're in a province where good quality data is being collected, at least internally. Maybe not released. Some of it is difficult to release for privacy reasons when it is medical data, but that at least it's being collected and analyzed in a coherent fashion internally. And I think what we're seeing is that this is not happening in many instances. Right? We've seen it in schools, but even in long-term care, which is a much, it's a much higher vulnerability situation. There we've had the province now saying that they can't release individual facility level data because it was too much work to collect it. Well, if it's too much work to collect, I mean, data entry and all this is hard, I get it, it takes time. But if we don't have that data, we're not watching. If we're not watching, we're not analyzing, we're not improving. That's a problem. And I don't understand why a year in now, we are still in this situation where we don't have good processes to collect this data and to analyze this data. If this was a problem in March, yes, healthcare has been underfunded. Maybe these systems weren't in place, but we've had a lot of time to build up this capacity, and apparently we haven't. And that's incredibly frustrating.
So could the province's kind of lack of transparency or lack of clarification in the slides with COVID data actively be endangering the public?
I think it's not something where they deliberately said, well, we're not going to give out that data. I think what's really going on here is that they actually don't have it in a form that it can be easily and comprehensively analyzed. And yes, is that something that's hampering our response? Absolutely. We want that data so that we can make with confidence, with whatever confidence we can get from that data, as confident as possible, we want to make those decisions. Right. So I think in this sense, it's really just a leadership issue where at some point we should have gone and said, look, we need good data, good quality data. We need good analysis that we can build on that data. Without the data, we can't build good analysis. Without good analysis, we can't make improvements that really help effectively. If I compare it to just as a simple example, Taiwan is a great place to look at if we want to think about what was the good response. Back in January last year, so a year ago, they recognized that this is a problem. They recognized from a very similar SARS experience in 2003 that we've had in Canada, they recognized that data is an integral part, which our SARS report recognized too, but we didn't really act on it the same way. And they realized they did not have the top level data infrastructure in place to support something like this. So they said, okay, they put in a 72-hour effort with a team of experts to build a designated system just for COVID, for reporting, for supporting quarantine and self-isolation, for supporting contact tracing. They put that in 72 hours. They integrated it with the national healthcare system, with other governmental system, with a travel system so that they can track incoming travelers and really get everybody into the right places at the right time. And that's great. So they started from scratch with a brand new system. These kind of systems for a very specific purpose for COVID, they're fast to build, easy to maintain. You can, if it's something like that's new and modern like this, you can adapt it as you learn, as you go along, make tweaks to it. And it's great. I don't understand why we haven't been learning from experiences like this.
Yeah, so that's the end of my list of questions. Do you have anything else you would like to add?
No, I think you got it covered.
All right. Thank you so much for meeting with me this morning.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
We are the Jocelyn Pettit Band, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to a democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
And welcome back to On The Point by CITR 101.9 FM. And this is your source for alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And you just heard an interview with Jens von Bergmann about the province's lack of data clarity about COVID-19. And I highly encourage you to check out his blog post on his website, Mountain Math. It's great. It's long, but it really goes into depth about, you know, BC's COVID modeling. And on the topic of COVID, let's talk about some announcements that happened yesterday as you're listening to this from, you know, Dr. Bonnie Henry in the Public Health Office. So BC confirmed two more cases of the UK COVID variant, the one that was supposed to be more infectious. Both of them were close contacts of the first known case. And she, Dr. Bonnie Henry doesn't believe that everyone else is at risk of this. So, you know, there's that. And also, this is predictable, the social gathering restrictions will be extended for one more month. They're supposed to end yesterday, but, you know, They're going to be extended until February the 5th, midnight. And that's mostly because hospitalizations have still stayed extremely high and cases aren't really, the curve isn't really bending down. It's sort of still up there, still creating a very nice ramp for any potential skaters. So, I mean, is there any major thoughts about either of these? I think it's sort of expected. The thing that there's a lot of criticism has happened in the past. I think sort of the people have sort of turned on the public health office way more than you know, the past few months of the pandemic. And there's been a lot of criticism around the fact that the sort of Atlantic Canadian model hasn't been replicated around the whole of Canada. So there was an article in the CBC about this and how some academics and people from SFU and UBC and everything are calling for not exactly COVID zero, which is Atlantic Canada's model, but COVID near zero. Not a very catchy name. I think they should have worked on that one. But basically saying that the provinces should work together in order to sort of limit the cases to a place where contact testing is fully operational, and then you can start thinking about other things. So I don't know. Because the vaccines are already, you know, happening. Alum of the show, Josh Azizi, had a report on his station, which I forget the name of, which is really bad of me, but you know, shout out to Josh. He had a report about how there are vaccines coming to, you know, northern indigenous communities and stuff. So they are happening at a rate of you know, a few thousand a day, and obviously that will be stepped up pretty soon. But you know, we'll have to see. The light at the end of the tunnel isn't a spotlight. It's more like a really bad pixel that you see on your monitor on a black screen. That's what the light at the end of the tunnel looks like for me. Anyway, let's talk about some other news and some more local news, Maddie.
Yeah, so both the Tai and a few other publications have covered recently that there was a police execution early, I think, in the evening on January 5th, which would have been Tuesday. Basically, local police shot and killed and injured an unclothed man who was on Hastings, I think, near Princess in the downtown east side. Basically, police arrived when they said they'd received reports that a man was chasing people with a sword. He was presumably in a state of psychosis after he ran into a plexiglass window at the facility where he was staying, breaking the window on the second... the second time he collided with it and injuring himself in the process. It's obviously just incredibly sad news. Also, I think the main criticism here, of course, being the police execution, when witnesses said that the police had given pretty much no, this is anecdotally, of course, but basically no warning to the man once they'd arrived on the scene, that there was a considerable distance between the man with the police officers. And although he was armed, there was criticism within the community that that they, you know, they could have used a number of different approaches, including, you know, tasing him rather than the three fatal shots that they did decide to use. So I'm sure we'll get more information on this in the next couple of weeks, and as of now, the identity of the man hasn't been released. But yeah, stay tuned. I believe there is a visual planned at 380 East Hastings on the 12th. So
yeah, and there's a great post on the Mainlander written by the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users about just how, because there's a CCTV image that they're using in that article, and you know, obviously the man is carrying something, but you know, you can see the police officer, you know, quite far away from him, and from all the witness reports that are in the media right now, it seems like they really didn't, it was sort of plan A was shooting, from what I can see. I mean, I wasn't there, this is just purely from what I've seen, and that is just really disheartening, right? Because we've had a year of resistance against this sort of stuff. And we had a, you know, very famous, in BC, we had a case of a wellness check, you know, where a police officer was dragging someone along the floor when they were clearly in distress. And I mean, I don't know what to say apart from this shouldn't have happened. And this is, I mean, this was one shooting. There was another shooting, a police shooting a few days before this. So like, all, it's been a week into the new year and we've already had two incidents like this. Like, this is just not sustainable in any way for anyone.
Yeah. And I think it's really, I mean, it's representative of obviously institutionalized violence, but I think on top of that, you think about the neighborhood and you think about, you know, this isn't how anything resembling mental health issues should be handled. And obviously it's complicated when somebody is violent and potentially causing harm to themselves and others, but killing them is still not the option that you default to. And when you have things like existing mental illness and trauma compounded with substance use and addiction, compounded with things like living in extreme poverty, like you have people who are in very, very challenging and delicate mental states, and they don't deserve to be executed for the circumstances that they find themselves in. So yeah, I think there's just, it's obviously inexcusable, and there just has to be a better way to deal with this. So.
Well, I guess we will never know. On the topic of, again, more and more things that make you question your faith in the world, there's some more stuff that came across the border. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so some photographers were attacked at a pro-Trump rally in downtown Vancouver. A CBC News journalist, Ben Nelms, said that he was punched in the face by a protester who was upset that the journalists were taking pictures and covering the event. And this was happening on the same day that in Washington, D.C., protesters were breaking into the U.S. Capitol building. And it's just... And it's emblematic of the violence, I guess, perpetrated by Trump supporters who refused to accept the results of the election.
Yeah. Obviously, Trump has been a bit of a lightning rod for these sorts of folks. Like, it's no secret, especially in North America. So this is not surprising. It is very sad. And it's also... Ben Nam specifically should go look up his Twitter. There are pictures of him taking pictures of the woman as she punches him, which I think is beyond the line of duty. Shouldn't have been doing that. But yeah, there were similar pro-Trump demonstrations in all across major Canadian cities, which tells you all you need to know, really. There's something else I wanted to say. Yes, so the Vancouver Trump demonstration, I mean, there were on New Year's Eve and Christmas Day and stuff, there were like anti-lockdown protests also. So like, it seems like if you're in the market for like really bad like bunting and like protest signs, you know, you're there right now. So you know, it's really wild when you have no regard for like anyone's safety, you could just do whatever and nothing will happen to you. It's the best. I wish I had no morals in life, you know, sometimes. Ugh.
Yeah. I hate to be the like search for a silver lining person right now, but because the last section of our show has been such a phenomenal bummer, I think it's probably worth pointing out that like, at least based on the photographs that I have seen, I cannot attest to it, I was not there, but at least in the anti-mask rallies and in the pro-Trump rallies in Vancouver, there's not that many people out there for these things. Like, truly, it's unfortunate, obviously, that anyone is there at all, but, like, the numbers are still pretty laughable, if I'm going to be totally honest. So, like, obviously, it's a very disheartening time in the world, but I also think that, like, it is important to remember that, like, don't let the voices of the few override any general confidence in the population entirely, you know? So, I don't know. I feel like as much as I hate to be that person, that is, you know, there's not very many people in those frames at the pro-Trump rally, so.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
On that rousing note, I guess we'll end the show there. So that's our show today. You know, it's our first show of the year, so thank you so much for listening. If you're a returning listener, especially, thank you for coming back. We have a, you know, 2021 is going to be an interesting year, and we hope that we can keep bringing you like local news and some more interesting voices to, you know, keep you company throughout this year. So this has been On the Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news, and you know, we speak to you in the, you know, more throughout 2021. But for now, stay tuned for more amazing programming.